This is the Big E Sports Show on SB Nation Radio.
And online at SBNationLive.com.
Live from the O'Reilly Auto Parts Studios in Houston, here's Alyssa Walker-Campbell.
Okay, we are back. SB Nation Radio, the Big E Sports Show, the fastest 2 hours in radio. As always, you can connect with us in a variety of ways. We are live at Twitter, at eRadio Sports Podcast. Arena.com, podcastarena.com, amazing shows there. And also you can email the show at info@eradiosports.com. Before we get underway with our book review here in hour number two, we want you to thank O'Reilly Auto Parts for all your car care needs. They are close, convenient. They are known for their guaranteed everyday low price. Stop by your local O'Reilly Auto Parts store today. O'Reilly's, better parts, better prices every day. As promised, before the commercial break, you know what we were talking about? We're going to go around the horn, walk down memory lane. We are going to highlight a very special book that has just been released. It is titled A Season in the Sun, The Rise of Mickey Mantle. And we are so delighted to have with us tonight for the very first time. He is a baseball historian. He is an author, and he is with us, and that is Johnny Smith. Good evening, Johnny.
Hey, good to hear from you. Thanks for having me on the show.
Well, it's great to have you on the program. And I have to tell you, you know, when we think of Mickey Mantle, there's just been so much written about him throughout the years. Why did you decide to write a book about Mickey Mantle?
You know, Randy Roberts and I have collaborated on another book before, and about Muhammad Ali. And when we were done with that project, we were talking about the major icons in the 20th century, the sports icons who really define their times. And one of the things we noticed about the other books about Mickey Mantle is that those stories, those books focused on, you know, who was Mickey Mantle? But the questions we're asking in our book is, what did Mickey Mantle mean to America? What did he mean to baseball in the 1950s when the sport still reigned as the national pastime? And to find those answers, we turn to 1956. That's the year that Mickey Mantle wins the Triple Crown. He wins the MVP. He leads the Yankees to a 7-game World Series victory against the Brooklyn Dodgers. But more importantly, in following Mantle's journey that season, we discover that that's the season when the nation embraced Mickey Mantle as the face of baseball, as the country's favorite athlete.
Okay, it is hour number two, SB Nation Radio, the Big E Sports Show. We have been going one-on-one with sports historian and author Johnny Smith. We got to step aside for a quick break, and we will be right back.
This is the Big E Sports Show on SB Nation Radio. Live from the O'Reilly Auto Parts Studios in Houston, here's Alyssa Walker-Campbell.
Welcome back. Hour number two, SB Nation Radio, the Big E Sports Show. Right now, we're going to continue our conversation with baseball historian and author Johnny Smith. Well, of course, in 1956, just a historic season, but as you'd mentioned, winning the Triple Crown. Why was this so special to Mickey Mantle?
We should keep this in mind. Before Mickey Mantle, there had never been a switch-hitting slugger. That means that there had never been a baseball player who could hit from the right side of the plate and the left side of the plate with such power. And in 1956, Mantle became only the fifth player in baseball history to win the Triple Crown in all of baseball. There have been other Triple Crown winners in the American League and the National League, respectively. And since Mantle won the Triple Crown in 1956, there have been three hitters who have won just in the American League. But no hitter since Mantle has led all of Major League Baseball in home runs, RBIs, and batting average in a single season. Now, I think those statistics are important, but they're not just numbers. They speak to the very hold that statistics have on baseball fans, on America. Those numbers etch Mantle's name into the history of greatness. They mark his place in the history of the game. This is a feat that neither Babe Ruth or Joe DiMaggio had ever achieved, and it was Mantle's moment where he really arrived and set himself apart as the best player in the game.
Mickey Mantle, so loved, so appreciated. Did he, at the end of his life, you know, did he truly understand what he meant to the fans and the game of baseball?
You know, when he was dying, you know, he was sick. He was an alcoholic. And what he had to come to terms with late in his life was that he was not always a very good husband. he was not always a very present father.
Right.
And one of the things he told Bob Costas and other reporters who interviewed him was about his regrets. You know, people know about Mantle that when he was a ball player in the 50s and 60s, that he was a carouser. He was a philanderer. Right. He drank heavily. But one of the things we talk about in A Season in the Sun is that you really have to understand why Mantle drank. And I think there are a couple reasons. Number one is, this was a very young man who was still grieving the loss of his father. His father, Mutt Mantle, died in 1952, and Mantle would later say that in the winter of 52-53, when Billy Martin, his best friend and teammate on the Yankees, came to visit him in Oklahoma, all they did was drink, and stay up late, and it got worse and worse. The other thing that we have to keep in mind is this. When Mantle becomes a star of New York, when he goes out with Billy Martin and Whitey Ford and the guys, and he goes to the Copacabana, and he goes to Tootsie Shores, and he goes out to any other nightclub, the people who see him there, his friends, the fans, anyone in the public, they see Mickey Mantle. And that meant a certain expectation of how he behaved in public. Part of that meant that if these people saw him, they wanted to buy him a drink. Alcohol was the drug of choice in the 1950s. And so they would buy him a bottle of champagne or a shot or a beer or whatever he was drinking, and he had to accept. Part of being Mickey Mantle was accepting those offers. It was drinking hard and waking up the next day and playing with a hangover and still knocking of the ball out of the ballpark. He would later say that that was the definition of a man, drink hard, play hard.
You're listening to The Voice, Johnny Smith, baseball historian, author, who is with us tonight, SB Nation Radio, the Big E Sports Show. This is a fascinating read, A Season in the Sun, The Rise of Mickey Mantle. I want to step back just a moment. You were talking about how he's a carouser, not a good, you know, husband and father. And as I understand, he had four sons. What kind of teammate, though, was Mickey Mantle?
That's a great question. You know, if you think about the guys he played with, Hall of Famers, regular All-Stars. One of his teammates, Hank Bauer, said later of Mantle that if you asked all the guys in the Yankee locker room who they admired the most, who they respected the most, they would say Mickey. And the reason was this. Mantle suffered a number of debilitating injuries throughout his career. You know, tore up his right knee in the 1951 World Series. He had frequent hamstring injuries, groin pulls, all sorts of problems that plagued him. He had to truly go through all sorts of preparations just to get on the field, wrapping his leg like a mummy just to suit up. And you could watch him play running around the bases on these brittle legs, limping. And the guy said, you know, Mickey is the one that we can count on, even when he's in pain. He doesn't complain. He doesn't talk to you about how much it hurts. Now, of course, part of the other reason that he drank was to numb that pain, the physical pain that he felt, to get through another game. And so I think it's important to keep in mind that, you know, what these teammates really admired about him was someone who had courage, who risked his own body, his own well-being, his own health for the glory of the team, but also the fact that he persevered. And I think increasingly as the fans followed Mickey's career and they saw that he was struggling through these injuries, they admired him even more. Because Mantle displayed his weaknesses, mm-hmm. and the fans rooted for him to overcome those flaws, to overcome the injuries, and I think that's what made him so popular in the locker room and in the stands.
Okay, we are highlighting a brand new book, A Season in the Sun, The Rise of Mickey Mantle, and author Johnny Smith with us tonight, SB Nation Radio, The Big E Sports Show. Certainly when we think of Mickey Mantle, Hall of Fame career, perhaps what his greatest regret is retiring, in 1969, had a total of 500 home runs, three MVPs, a shortened career. But I think the good news that, you know, really inspires all of us is that at the end of his life, Johnny, he was a changed man, right?
You know, I think what he recognized is that he had a responsibility. And that responsibility was to tell people who did admire him, grown men who would write him letters or see him at a baseball card or a memorabilia show and say, hey, you were my hero. Late in his life, when he opened up about his struggles with alcohol and his shortcomings within his family, he acknowledged those things. You know, he went to Alcoholics Anonymous.
That's right.
And he would tell people, you know, I'm not the hero you thought I was. I have my shortcomings. But that, I think, was seen as sort of this moment of redemption. When he told the kids, don't be like me, what he was saying is, you know, think about how you take care of yourself. Think about how you treat others. That's not to say that we should look at Mickey Mantle simply as a tragic figure either. In fact, one of the things that we're doing in A Season in the Sun is reminding the readers, the baseball fans, who know about Mickey Mantle's story, to think about how he was viewed in the 1950s. In the 1950s, particularly in 56, we see that this is a guy who was embraced throughout the country. Even when the Yankees went to other major league stadiums, there were fans who were rooting for him because he was pursuing Babe Ruth's single-season home run record. They wanted to see Mighty Mickey. That was what they called him in the press. They wanted to see Mighty Mickey hit a ball farther than they'd ever seen before. He had the potential to harness that raw power in a way that fans had never seen before. And so I think what we want to do in this book is to get people to think about Mantle as he was seen in the 1950s, at the height of his career, at the height of his fame.
The title of the book is A Season in the Sun, The Rise of Mickey Mantle. And, of course, we're visiting tonight with Johnny Smith, baseball historian. He teamed up with his colleague Randy Roberts. And where can they go? Everywhere, I guess, just online to pick up a copy of the book, Amazon.com, Barnes & Noble.
Absolutely. It's available in those places and pretty much any major book retailer.
Okay, we're getting ready to wrap up our interview. What's the one thing, just through this whole process and chronicling and sharing this story, what did you learn?
You know, one of the things that fascinated me is that in 1955, so the season before Mantle wins the Triple Crown and the MVP, in 1955, Mantle was, without a doubt, the best hitter in the American League. But that summer, when the Yankees were playing the Red Sox, Mantle took the field in the first inning, and his own fans in Yankee Stadium were booing him. That's right, Mickey Mantle was booed in Yankee Stadium.
Wow.
And the reason I bring that up is to remind people that Mickey Mantle faced incredible expectations when he came to New York to be the next Joe DiMaggio, to be as great of a slugger as Babe Ruth. He had faced unprecedented expectations. And that mounting pressure really wore on him. But it wasn't until 1956 that New York fully embraced him, that they saw him as someone who did go all out, who fulfilled those expectations of greatness that season.
Hey, what kind of feedback have you received from the book since it's been released, Johnny?
You know, one of the things that I've been proud to hear from people is that this is not your typical Mickey Mantle biography.
I agree.
And the reason for that is Randy Roberts and I, we're professional historians. We study the history of American sports. And so what we try to do is write a good narrative history, but place it in a historical context. And so what you learn about in this book is Mantle's place in American culture in the 1950s. You learn about baseball history. You learn about the icons. You learn about the importance of celebrity culture in the 1950s and the role of New York sports writers during that time. We like to think that this is the kind of book that offers a more nuanced perspective of Mickey Mantle and baseball during this golden age.
It is amazing. The title of the book, A Season in the Sun, The Rise of Mickey Mantle. We have been visiting with a baseball historian, sports historian, that is Johnny Smith, and of course, his colleague, Randy Roberts. They teamed up on this particular project. You are a fantastic guest. Love your enthusiasm about this book. I know you're so excited to have it on the shelves. And Johnny, let's reconvene and talk again real soon. Thank you so much, sir.
Thank you so much.
Absolutely. Stick around. Much more coming your way right here in hour number two at SB Nation Radio and the Big E Sports Show.
This is the Big E Sports Show on SB Nation Radio, live from the O'Reilly Auto Parts Studios in Houston. Here's Alyssa Walker-Campbell.
Hey, welcome back, SB Nation Radio and the Big E Sports Show. Alyssa Walker-Campbell along with you, fastest 2 hours in radio. Before we get underway with our next segment, think O'Reilly Auto Parts for all your car care needs. They are close, convenient, and known for their guaranteed everyday low price. Stop by your local O'Reilly Auto Parts store today. O'Reilly's, better parts, better prices every day. As promised, that's right, we are going to break down NBA playoffs 2018. Teen Edition. And the talk continues here tonight, and we are thrilled to have back with us from Fox 25 Television. He is the sports director there in Oklahoma City, our dear friend of the show, and that is Myron Patton. Welcome back, Myron.
Hello, how you doing?
Hey, I'm doing great. Good to have you on the program. And, of course, we invited you on the show tonight to recap the Thunder and ultimately how their season played out. There was a lot of ups and downs and disappointments, but we are in Houston, and tonight it is Game 3 with the Jazz on the road and the Rockets. The series is tied. What are some of your takeaways from watching this particular series?
The Jazz and Rockets, I think Utah is showing people that they're better than what people thought. They kind of looked at it being Oklahoma City upsetting them, and I think they thought that Houston would kind of handle them pretty easy, but they're a really good team led by Donovan Mitchell. He's, a star player, but the pieces fit pretty well. Joe Ingles, you leave him open, he'll knock down shots. Gobert anchors the defense. They're well coached. And, of course, they've been playing this series, most of the series, without Ricky Rubio. They're very good.
Yeah.
Very good. I'm saying Houston will get it done, though.
Ultimately, perhaps Houston will get it done. But I think you're right, Meyer, and I think a lot of folks underestimated just how good the Jazz are. But I had an opportunity to watch, the Thunder and the Jazz go at it, and I was like, I think the Jazz can be a very dangerous team. Do you think they can extend this series with the Rockets? Of course, tonight, they are at home.
Yeah, certainly so. I think if you don't take them, I don't want to say Houston took them lightly, but I think you can kind of get low into the trap that, putting up a lot of points scoring can become easy. And Utah's an excellent defensive team with Gobert kind of backing things up. Even if you get beat off the dribble, he's there to kind of correct any mistakes and allows you to be more aggressive on the front end. And I think that helps that defense on quite a bit.
When you talk about the defense of the Jazz, one of the guys that comes to my mind, too, is Jay Crowder. Of course, he contributed on Wednesday night, 15 points, and then Burks with 17, and you add that up, that's for 32 points off the bench to give them a win in Game 2, and that certainly energizes you when you've got the depth on the bench and they're able to platoon those guys.
Yeah, and Alec Burks has kind of lost in the rotation.
Yeah.
He played against Oklahoma City in Game 1.
Yeah.
And then he's kind of found his way back. Jay Crowder's got some experience and also some physicality, and that bench, they go pretty deep. Just a starting five.
Hey, glad you're with us tonight. SB Nation Radio, the Big E Sports Show. We've got many different platforms where you can connect with us. Join us at Twitter at eRadio Sports, podcastarena.com, and you can always email the show at info@eradiosports.com. Hey, Myron Patton is with us, KOKH Sports Director in Oklahoma City with Fox. Myron, how can our listeners connect with you? Where can they check you out online and on the waves?
Well, I've got my own radio show here in town.
Yeah.
You can check us out at KMBIFM.com. We're on we've got an app out there for you Android and iPhone users. Of course, if you're in town, it's 105.3 on the FM dial as well. So a lot of things to listen.
Myron, they've got to close out on shooters, no doubt about that. Okay, so let's move ahead. Let's talk about the Oklahoma City Thunder, their season. You've had some time to kind of, think about how it all played out and marinate on this. Myron, give us the pulse on the Thunder. Were you pretty disappointed? Because it really didn't turn out the way it was supposed to.
No, they didn't go nearly as deep as you thought they'd do. They won 48 games in the season. That's just one more than the season before. And you had guys like Paul George and Carmelo Anthony, you do more than that, and they only won, didn't get out of the first round of the playoffs. So it was a disappointing year. And biggest thing with them, they just weren't consistent enough. They never found that consistency, especially on the offensive end. They were good defensively, but offensively, they never found that cohesion for long stretches to win that allowed them to go the long winning streaks and really win a series against the Utah Jazz team. So it was a disappointing year from that standpoint, because you expected a whole lot more when you had all-stars like they did.
And when I watched the Jazz series with the Thunder, it just seemed like OKC, they were not ever, in control or command in that series at all. The Jazz looked like the better team. I hate to say it, right?
I think matchups are also a big part of series, and Utah was a really good matchup from their standpoint against Oklahoma City, because Oklahoma City is a team that's like, they like to attack the rim, especially with Russell Westbrook, and with Gobert being a supreme shot blocker, that's kind of going right into the teeth of them. And again, they can press upon you. If you get bombed, he's going to correct any mistakes. The two games that they won, Oklahoma City won, Gobert's in foul trouble in both those. Mm-hmm. So that was he was kind of the key to the defensive for them. And then you got Donovan Mitchell from an offensive standpoint, rookie, whatever you want to call him, this guy can play. He's one of the players in the league, and I think the rest of the NBA knew, but I think maybe fans don't follow the league as much. They're finding out how good he is.
So, Myron, what is the top priority in the offseason? Are they going to keep Paul George? And does he have a willing, heart to maybe even come off the bench? I mean, what do you think?
Well, they want to keep Paul George. That's the first thing they got to figure out this offseason. He obviously holds all the cards. He wants to go back to L.A. and where he grew up in Palmdale, California, and play. I mean, we'll see how they play that. I think they got a shot then, but, what it's going to be like with Magic Johnson gets in that room and starts talking about rings, and championships. Carmelo Anthony, the question mark, he wants to change his bow. I don't think he wants to play that four. He wants more mid-range. He wants more touches. He holds the cards. In fact, he can opt out or opt into his contract. He's due $28 million. A guy in his 16th year is not going to get that anywhere else. He's going to want to stay, but if you want to stay under the role they want him to play, so that's going to be an issue that they're going to have to work out this offseason as well in terms of his role. He don't want to come off the bench. He's not a guy that's, his personality is not such that he can go to the bench like a Dwayne Wade or somebody like that. He wants to start, so that's going to be the golf business offseason priority for him to kind of figure out what happens with him. And he kind of holds all the cards because he's got a no-trade clause and things like that. So that's going to be interesting how that works out.
Okay, as we look ahead, when we talk about the Oklahoma City Thunder, the 2018-2019 season, it will be year four for head coach Billy Donovan. Give us an assessment, Myron, of just the job that he has done there.
Yeah, I think he's done a pretty good job. I think people, they want more out of him. And I think he, from a win-loss standpoint, he wants more. But I think what you have to remember is he's been here, this will be his fourth year. Every year, he's never come back to the same team he thought he was going to have.
Mm-hmm.
He got here the first year. They go to the West Finals. Then Kevin Durant leaves. Then they come back, and, of course, you got Russ and some younger guys. Victor Oladipo comes in. And then as that group, then this year it was Paul George and Carmelo, and it was a major change in the lineup from year to year. And even as we talk right now, I have no idea what the roster looks like. Is Paul George going to be back? Is Melo going to be back? Jeremy Grant's a free agent. All this, there's been major changes in the roster for every year he's been here. So I think you've got to take that into account. Next year will be big for him. Year four, in terms of what, if they have a disappointing year, I think a lot of people kind of scream on this job this year. Next year, the Heat will probably turn up a little bit more. But I think he's a good coach, but I think he's also been kind of hampered with some issues with the lineup that's out of his control.
Mm-hmm.
The basketball things, the way things work for him, and things of that nature.
Yeah, very challenging as a head coach when you don't have continuity, what you're talking about in your lineup. Hey, tonight you guys have been listening to the voice of Myron Patton, Fox 25 Television in Oklahoma City. And Myron, once again, connect with our listeners. Where can they check you out online?
Yeah, check us out at KNDFM, KINDFM.com, which is just a website. And it's got a listen tab there as well. 105.3. The other field out if you're here in town. You can also get us on the app if you're an Android iPhone user. If you're in town, call me up. I love doing talk radio as well as the TV side.
Absolutely. We always love visiting with Myron Patton, KOKH, sports director in Oklahoma.
This is the Big E Sports Show on SB Nation Radio. Live from the O'Reilly Auto Parts Studios in Houston, here's Alyssa Walker-Campbell.
Hey, Alyssa Walker-Campbell. Welcome back. SB Nation Radio and the Big E Sports Show. As promised, it is time to go around the horn. We are going to zero in on the Los Angeles Dodgers. But before we get underway with our next interview, we always got to pause, take time to recognize our corporate partners and sponsors, and that is O'Reilly Auto Parts. Think of them for all your car care needs. They are close, convenient. They are known for their guaranteed everyday low price. Stop by your local O'Reilly Auto Parts store today. O'Reilly's, better parts, better prices every day. As I said, yep, we're going to talk some baseball and the Los Angeles Dodgers. You know what? They are one of the most storied franchises in all of sports, an enduring legacy, both on and off the diamond. It is an amazing organization and, of course, so strong with their pitching throughout the years. And we have selected a new book that we are going to highlight tonight of the extraordinary pitching tradition. And we are thrilled to be joined with a national sports writer. He is actually in public relations with Showtime, and he's joining us for the very first time at SB Nation Radio, my new friend, John Weissman. Good evening, John.
Hi, how are you?
John, it's great to have you with us. And, of course, we want to take time to recognize, we've also got to take time to mention the new book that you have just produced, Brothers in Arms, Koufax, Kershaw, and the Dodgers' Extraordinary Pitching Tradition. We will highlight that in just a moment. But I'd love for you to provide an update on the Dodgers, how the first month of the season had to play out, because from what I understand, they really have had to muscle through a lot of adversity, John.
Yeah, it has not played out well. It's almost been a case of everything that could have gone wrong has gone wrong. There are some exceptions, like they've gotten some unexpected production out of Matt Kemp in the outfield. But basically, they've had three-fourths of their starting infield is on the disabled list in Logan Forsythe, Justin Turner, who hasn't played a game yet this year, and Corey Seager, their MVP candidate, who's after the season because of Tommy John surgery.
Mm-hmm.
Yasiel Puig's on the disabled list, and he hadn't been hitting before that point. We just learned that Hyung-Jun Ryu, who had been their best pitcher for the first month of the season, is going to probably be out till the All-Star break because of a groin injury suffered last Wednesday night. And so it's they've fallen eight games behind in the division, which isn't unprecedented for them to make a comeback, but they've definitely, like you said, got a lot of adversity they've got to overcome.
Well, of course, last year, 104-58 first in the NL West, so perhaps they can get that momentum to shift. You talked about a lot of the things that have gone wrong in this first month, John. What has gone right?
Well, Jock Peterson's had a little bit of a resurgence. You might remember he was optioned to the minors in late summer of last year and then came back and hit three home runs during the World Series, which was pretty unexpected. He still wasn't in a starting spot this year, but because of the injuries, time has opened up, and he's been productive, as has another guy, catcher Yasmani Grandal, who hardly played in the World Series last year, but he's been the Dodgers' best hitter this year.
Hey, glad you're with us tonight. SB Nation Radio, the Big E Sports Show, talking with national sports writer, author. Of course, he is with Showtime, and that is John Weissman. And we would love to connect with you. You can join us at Twitter at eRadioSports. Always email the show at info@eradiosports.com. You know, John, just a moment ago, you were just talking about the slew of injuries. I want to hear some more about the loss of your star shortstop for the Dodgers, Corey Seager. So he's going to have Tommy John surgery. It requires him, you know, some are saying, as you did, that to miss the remainder of the 2018 season. How devastating is this to the Dodgers? And is there any chance that he could at least even make it back by the month of August?
No, he'll definitely be out for the year. I think the goal is to have him ready by opening day of 2019, and even that could, you know, possibly he can miss a month. It's probably a 12-month, it could be a 12-month recovery for him. And it is probably among their position players the biggest loss they could have, because in addition to being one of their best hitters, if not their best hitter, he played a premium position at shortstop where they really now have to move things around short of making a big trade to replace him. So they've got guys like Kike Hernandez and Chris Taylor filling in right now. And then, like I said, that opens up a little bit of spot in the outfield. But they're really mixing and matching this point, and no one can match the production of a healthy Seager, who really, a rookie of the year, who, you know, a top five MVP candidate if he's healthy. But this has been an issue for him since last August, this elbow, and they've tried to sort of tenderly get through it, and finally over the weekend series they recently had against the Giants, it just basically gave way.
How tough of an obstacle is this for the Dodgers to overcome and fill that void? I mean, it's a big challenge.
I think there's a serious question about whether this is the injury that they can't overcome. And of course, we're still in early May, so it's a little soon to give up on the season, especially with a wild card possibility. I mean, Arizona is rightfully now considered a top contender because they've raced out to such a great start. And whether or not the Dodgers can catch the Diamondbacks remains to be seen. But the wild card race is still extremely wide open. And if you consider the fact that the Dodgers are four or five games out in the wild card while having so many things go wrong for them, I think you can still see a pathway for them to the postseason. And in October, all bets are off, basically. But yeah, they need to. They have some guys who have been healthy who do need to step up their production. So it's particularly in the bullpen, that's been a big problem for them this year. So they need both better health and better performance, and both those things are possible, but not guaranteed.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so eight games back, the Dodgers are eight games back from the Diamondbacks. What are the keys to get the Dodgers moving forward? I mean, obviously, getting healthy, or you know.
Yeah, I'll elaborate on the bullpen a little bit. One of the things has been, you know, that bullpen starts with Kenley Jansen, their all-star closer, and he has just not been really right this year. Through the first 30 games of the season, he had yet to throw a 1-2-3 inning. So the ninth inning, which used to be so automatic for the Dodgers, is anything but right now. They have had some good performances in the bullpen, but they've also had some guys that have just not been what they needed to be, and they had a particularly bad stretch of before Ryu got injured, where they allowed something like 14 runs in 12 innings, and
wow,
they haven't been able to hold leads, and they haven't been able to keep the Dodgers in the game. There have been a couple times when, say, the Dodgers have been down, you know, 3-1 or 4-3 or something, and within range of a comeback. And then the bullpen gives up a couple more runs, and the Dodgers end up losing that game 8-6, which is, you know, just hard to take if you're a Dodger fan. So, again, it's a mix of finding the right players that are going to bring that bullpen forward, and we'll see what happens with that.
And speaking of pitching, let's move ahead. Let's highlight your brand-new book, Brothers in Arms, Koufax Kershaw, and the Dodgers' extraordinary pitching tradition. And just congratulations on this, John. I thought you did a beautiful job for, you know, all Dodger fans, young and old, and just, you know, going through and chronicling just some of the greatest that have ever been a part of the game of baseball, not just with the Dodgers organization.
Yeah, it was a real pleasure to write, and it was amazing to me, frankly, that the book hadn't been written already, because I think in the same fashion that you hear about, say, the Bronx Bombers, when you think of the New York Yankees, the Dodgers are really identified with this pitching tradition, and, you know, other than, say, Jackie Robinson or Vin Scully, it's really the sort of the defining characteristic of the team, and so it was just treat to go back, to have the opportunity to go back and look through, not only tell the stories of roughly 25 really quality individual pitchers, from Ralph Branca, who was an underrated pitcher before the 1951 home run that he allowed that was so famous, to from Branca to Kershaw. It's great to tell those stories, and it was also great to tell the story of how the Dodger pitching tradition began, which was interestingly, I found you can credit Branch Rickey, who's the general manager who helped integrate baseball, you know, who brought us Jackie Robinson. Mm-hmm. Even before he did that, it was the same mentality, which is like, his mentality was, I want to find the best ball players I can, and I want to develop the best ball players I can. And so he put the focus on pitching in that organization in a way that really hadn't been done before. And for decades later, for basically the past seven decades, the Dodger pitching tradition has followed.
Hey, author John Weissman with us tonight, SB Nation Radio, the Big East Sports Show. We are shining the spotlight on his new book, Brothers in Arms, Koufax Kershaw and the Dodgers' Extraordinary Pitching Tradition. You know, when you think of some of the pitchers that have been a part of this organization, we highlight so many, you know, I'm thinking Koufax and Earl Hershiser, but what about the underappreciated pitchers that have been a part of this team?
Well, yeah, I mean, Branca is one of those pitchers because Branca was really sort of the first phenom of the Dodger pitching dominance. And everyone remembers because he gave up that Bobby Thompson home run in 1951, and he's sort of portrayed as like the ultimate victim on the mound. But prior to that time, he was really an extraordinary pitcher. He made his debut with the Dodgers as a teenager while World War II was still going on. And he was a three-time All-Star before turning 25. I mean, I don't know that 10% of the fans, Dodger fans, let alone baseball fans, realize just how good a pitcher he was. And, you know, in this era, he would have had pitch counts and pitch limits and been held back. In the era that he pitched in, they saw a healthy young arm and basically threw it out there every chance they could. One of my favorite anecdotes about him is that he started a game, gave up five runs in the first inning before he got an out, and then ended up finishing a 17-10 complete game victory, pitched all nine innings, and probably threw close to 175 to 200 pitches in that game. And, and then came back a few days later and pitched again. It's just crazy how good he was. And unfortunately, his career didn't last long enough to really sort of make a deeper impression, but it's stories like that that I really sought out to highlight in the book.
Hey, one of the most recognizable names, Clayton Kershaw. You got to talk about his career. What did you share about him?
Well, I mean, Clayton Kershaw was an interesting chapter to write just because obviously he's the one that people will know the most about. I really wanted to capture how he developed over time. Probably a distant memory for people that he, for example, came up in 2008. And was, you know, had a pretty solid debut game against the Cardinals, but then sort of struggled here and there. And he actually did get sent down to the minors midway through that season. And he was kind of a two-pitch pitcher and had, you know, relying mostly on fastball. And he did have that curveball that was made famous in this televised spring training game he had pitched that year. But he was a guy who was still very much needing to develop. And what you find is just, number one, his incredible work ethic that enabled him to develop kind of a different repertoire that didn't rely on the fastball and curve. And then also just like putting his career statistics in perspective, comparing them, adjusting them for the era, adjusting for the parks he's had to pitch in, and comparing them to Koufax. And he compares really so well to Koufax. And Kershaw's rightfully considered one of the greatest pitchers of all time. And then maybe one other thing I wanted to sort of put in perspective was his postseason performance, because he's often a target of criticism for not getting the Dodgers to the World Series or to a World Series title. And while his record there has been mixed, he's had several good games, great games in the postseason. And I think for some reason, because the Dodgers haven't won that last game, Kershaw's good performances get forgotten and only his poor ones get remembered. And I'd sort of like a takeaway for that to be that.
Veteran baseball writer John Weissman with us tonight, SB Nation Radio, the Big East Sports Show. We're going to step aside for a quick commercial break and we will be right back.
This is the Big East Sports Show on SB Nation Radio, live from the O'Reilly Auto Parts Studios in Houston. Here's Alyssa Walker-Campbell.
Welcome back. Hour number two, SB Nation Radio, the Big East Sports Show. We are shining the spotlight on a brand new book by John Weissman. Right now, let's rejoin that conversation. The title of the book is Brothers in Arms. It explores the generations of Dodgers royalty and how they shape the identity of the franchise. We've been going one-on-one with John Weissman. And John, you know, also include in the book a heartfelt foreword from the play-by-play broadcaster, Joe Davis. What did Joe share?
Well, it's interesting because, you know, Joe walked into really the hardest job in broadcasting, which was to succeed Vin Scully.
Yeah, no pressure.
not at all. And I feel like I got a coup in getting him to write the foreword. He's not obviously as famous as Vin Scully is now, and no one will ever replace Vin Scully, but I feel like you know, he's a guy that could be doing Dodger games himself for the next number of decades. And I feel like if you told me, for example, years ago, you can get a 29-year-old Vince Scully to write the foreword for your book,
yeah.
that'd be
incredible.
Thrilled, because that name's going to mean a lot more in the years to come. And I think what Joe conveyed in the foreword was just basically sort of the privilege of broadcasting for the Dodgers. He literally wrote it on a team flight, or he was sitting on the, you know, on a plane with Hershiser, his color commentator nearby, and Kershaw in a few rows away, and just talking about sort of the wonder of connecting those two guys and then going back further into history. You know, Fernando Valenzuela is a Spanish language broadcaster for the team, so you have that as well. And he definitely offered a nice little perspective for us to kick off the book.
Outstanding. Hey, veteran baseball writer John Weissman has been with us. Of course, he examines the rich history of the Dodgers, and the title of the book is Brothers in Arms, Koufax, Kershaw, and the Dodgers' Extraordinary Pitching Tradition. This is a fascinating read. John, first time on the show. Congratulations, and we would absolutely love to keep this an open invitation. We want to have you back. You're a great guest. Thank you, John.
Oh, thanks so much.
You bet. That, of course, was national sports writer and author John Weissman, who's been with us tonight, SB Nation Radio, the Big E Sports Show. A very special thank you to all of our amazing guests and our lineup, our own producer, Robert Harris, who joined us live in studio. We're going to step aside and see you next weekend for the biggest, the best in sports right here, the Big E Sports Show.